Hello, I'm Professor Bob Hewish from the Department of International Development Studies at Dalhousie University. You're listening to GDP, the Global Development Primer, the podcast dedicated to all issues in international development studies. Follow me on Twitter at Professor Hewish. And welcome back to another episode of GDP, the Global Development Primer podcast. For this week, we are joined once again by Oliver Schwenk. He's a senior economist in the Financing for Sustainable Development Office of the United Nations Department of Economic and Social Affairs. He's one of the authors of a recent study that's come out that we're going to talk about today. He's part of the policy analysis team that leads the substantive follow-up for the Addis Ababa Action Agenda on Financing for Development, and he focuses on debt sustainability and integrated financing frameworks. Now, prior to his current role, he held various positions for the Secretariat of the United Nations, including as part of the writing team of the World Economic and Social Survey, which is a flagship United Nations publication, and in the Office of the Special Advisor on Africa. He was also a consultant with UNIDO and a lecturer in development economics at the Vienna University of Economics and Business and at the University of Vienna. He holds a doctorate in economics from the Vienna University of Economics and Business. And today, Oliver Schwenk is joining us once again on the Global Development Primer podcast to talk about, well, shall we call it a crisis in sustainable development. Oliver, welcome back.
Thank you so much, Bob. Great to be here again.
Yeah, absolutely. So let's talk about some of the recent work that you've been doing. Particularly, I believe it was coming up to the launch of this discussion. There's a fourth international conference on financing for development coming up in June of 2025. But there's also a report that's come out about financing for a sustainable development report, which is a financing for development at the crossroads that came out on April 9th, 2024. Now, some of the content in that report leads us to believe that there's a crisis with the global sustainable with global sustainable development, with the sustainability goals. So my question to you to start things off, is the world off track to meeting the sustainable development goals? And if so, by how much?
Very much so, Bob. Indeed, that is our assessment of the 2024 financing report that we just put out. And as you said, this is a report that will ultimately inform discussions by world leaders at the next year's Conference on Financing for Development in 2025. And our assessment indeed is that we are in a sustainable development crisis, that the SDGs, our global sustainable development goals, are very much off track, and that financing challenges are often at the heart of this crisis. They are often the main reason why we are not where we want to be. Just to give you some examples, we have these 17 goals and many indicators that track progress. And on a majority of them, we are indeed off track. And that includes some of the core commitments that we've made in 2015, such as eradicating extreme poverty. If the world economy continues on the track that it's currently on, then right now we expect then more than 600 million people will still live in extreme poverty in 2030. So we are very far off track on one of the most critical commitments that we've made on eradicating extreme poverty. And the same holds true for many of our goals. I think another one that is on everybody's mind is climate action. You know, we should, at this stage, we should be reducing fossil fuel emissions very rapidly to stay within the 1.5 degree temperature increase limit that we've set ourselves. And instead, we see that fossil fuel use and emissions are still growing. And in this and in many other areas, it's often the financing policy decisions, the investment decisions that we are making today that are the reason for slow progress or even regression. You know, instead of closing those financing gaps, we see them growing. In our assessment, those financing gaps to invest in the global goals now amount to more than $4 trillion every year. That's up from around 2.5 trillion a couple of years ago. So instead of reducing them, they are growing. We are still subsidizing investments in fossil fuels, investments in unsustainable activities, instead of making sure that everyone has the incentives to invest in green transitions. So financing is really at the crux, and that's where the title comes from. We are at a crossroads. We can still turn things around, but to do that, we would have to fix the financing architecture, our financing policy decisions, and then we still have a chance to achieve some of those goals by 2030.
So what's happened here, Oliver? Like, we don't need any more wake-up calls to realize, like you say, with climate changes that are underway, the fact that many municipalities around the world are planning mitigation strategies for this. I mean, some small scale, like, you know, putting chainsaws on fire trucks to cut up trees that fall in hurricanes, or, you know, to revamping water runoff systems. I mean, as we're having this conversation, the airport in Dubai is under 5 inches of water. They just received more rain in the past day than they would usually in a year and a half. So, you know, we don't really need to game our wake-up calls here, but why is it that the financing, as you say, is sort of the crux to this, hasn't followed suit? Where have we lost the plot?
I think that is indeed a critical question, and there's a risk that I am, and probably other guests on your show, might be repeating themselves, right? We've made these calls before, and it is the big question, why hasn't this succeeded? Why haven't we lived up to our commitments? In our assessment, you know, one way to look at this is that this is a situation very much of a glass half full, glass half empty. It's not that nothing is being done. We can see actions across all the financing policy areas. You can take the example of concessional finance and support from rich to poor countries. That has reached record highs last year. So it's not like we are not doing anything. But I think the challenges are so large that they've really overwhelmed our capacities to respond, and the actions we've taken so far are not keeping pace with the challenges. So in this year's report, we took a broader time perspective to answer precisely the question you asked. Why have we failed to advance, even though we've been dealing with these questions for more than 20 years? And you look across policy areas and you'll see that there is meaningful action and meaningful progress in many areas, but it's just not keeping pace with the rising needs that come from the climate crisis, that come from the difficult geopolitical challenges we face today. So what's left to say is we just need to take our own commitment seriously and really accelerate action, live up to the commitments that we've all made to, you know, address the climate crisis.
Right. You know, and it's something that right now, you know, as I'm, you know, broadcasting here from Canada, we've had a lot of debate over whether or not should the financing of climate come down to things like carbon taxes, right? Do we need to keep charging more and more for carbon in order to put financing into programs that would then mitigate that? And what's sort of one of the underlying messages to this debate, and again, there's those who are very pro the tax, those are very anti, but there is something to it to say that, well, we don't have available alternatives that are accessible to everyone right now. So if you increase pricing of carbon for some, it's going to put them in a hard spot, and there's already lots of financial crisis. So, you know, it seems to me that perhaps some of the presented solutions to financing and improving financing for the climate crisis need some refinement to some degree. Yes.
I mean, I actually think this is a case where the discussions at the UN might be really ahead of their time and really provide answers to some of the challenges you would, for example, face in Canada. Right? At the UN, we think about the Sustainable Development Agenda, which really tries to tackle economic, social, and environmental issues in an integrated way. I know that's a lot of buzzwords and easy to roll your eyes at that, but I think it has very concrete implications. For the example you mentioned, I think it's true, and we've seen this in many countries. If you just focus on carbon pricing, there are so many social consequences that, you know, as sound as that approach might be in economic theory, in practice, it's politically not feasible because you have too many losers, you have too much resistance. So I think the way to turn this around is to think of this as a positive agenda of investment in those transitions. And I think that's also the countries that have succeeded in adopting very ambitious packages around these climate measures are ones that have really focused on the opportunity of investing in these transitions. And of course, keeping in mind that we have to compensate those that we lose from these very dramatic structural changes that we are imposing on our economies and societies. But to me, that's the answer, right? We have to think of this as a positive, as an investment agenda that can lift all boats, right? That can create new opportunities for people, and that can also revitalize economic prosperity.
Right. And it's something that, you know, as much as we're kind of banking on e-vehicles as being the one of the big drivers to get us out of this mess, it won't be enough. We've got to try to find that incentive structure you just mentioned to get back on track. But let's go more globally here for a second. And, you know, in terms of dollars, in terms of who needs to finance what, how much is needed to be spent, and from whom does it need to be spent from to meet the sustainable development goals? If like you say, we're going to meet that deadline of the goals with hundreds of millions of people still in poverty, we are not going to be there in a position to really say we can proudly declare mission accomplished on climate action. Who needs to open their wallets?
Well, so I think, not surprisingly, the answer to that is we need contributions from all sources of financing. And I think one has to start with the largest of all, which is mobilization of domestic revenue and taxes. That is the biggest opportunity to help countries mobilize more resources domestically to invest in these often public goods, right? These are often public goods that will need to be provided or at least supported publicly. And that's also where, you know, if you think about this financing gap in the trillions, that's where, you know, if you make real progress on that, and if countries are able to mobilize additional tax revenue, you can get to, you know, figures of that magnitude. But, and this is a really, really important caveat, you know, there are many countries that are not, you know, prosperous enough to do this on their own. So especially if you think about the poorest countries, of course, they also need international support. And the UN has been very vocal in the need to scaling up that international support. We understand that, you know, it's very difficult, especially at this moment, to ask taxpayers in rich countries to, you know, to mobilize a lot of additional resources. But we have vehicles in the international architecture that allow us to really leverage and scale up contributions that come from provider countries. I think the most prominent example are the development banks that we have. If we manage to strengthen these, if we allow them to use the capital they have more effectively, and if we, you know, provide them with additional capital, they can really lever those additional resources and significantly scale up financing. So, you know, there's calls from our Secretary General to aim for additional long-term financing from the multilateral development banks of around $500 billion annually. So that would, you know, that would really make a significant dent in those financing gaps. So we have the institutions that can deliver this. And I should also say, you know, this is something that policymakers around the world are very aware of, and they're very real efforts to help them scale up their financing. But right now we are not at the scale that we need to close those financing gaps. I've mentioned tax, I've mentioned, you know, international support. The third big bucket is private investment. You know, a lot of these, you know, think about the energy transition in particular, these are mostly private investments that need to happen. And there, again, there's many things we can do, but I think ultimately it comes down to setting the right incentives so that private investors, you know, have long enough time horizons and the right incentives to invest in, say, clean energy, the energy transition. And again, you know, there's a lot happening, as you know, but we can do more, we can do better from a public policy side to incentivize these types of private investments.
Right, right. And I think the multilateral banks that you've suggested are really important actors in this, because they can get at sort of that important level of overseeing infrastructure development and getting into things like power grids or getting into operations that would allow for the use and integration of cleaner technology. And sometimes that's overlooked when you've got, you know, political leaders coming to the forefront, or you've got the big international meetings taking place, that, you know, a gentle reminder to say, hey, look, there are these multilateral organizations that do have a role in financing some of this material to begin with.
Indeed, and they have they also can channel private finance, if you like, right? They issue bonds in financial markets, so they can, you know, absorb savings and investment by the private sector, and then lever that and pass it on to their client countries, to developing countries. So they are also a way to channel private finance to our public priorities.
So let's just sort of cover one more area here, that debt, of course, is on everyone's mind in 2024. Interest rates are up, cost of everything is more than it was, incomes are not keeping pace. How bad is it? And how many people are impacted by this increase of debt? Like, is it, you know, part of it is a lack of private financing going into these issues, but is debt something that's standing in the way of this as well from meeting these goals?
Very much so. Yeah. We really, at the UN, we really see that one of the major drivers of the current sustainable development crisis are the high debt and debt service burdens. So, you know, many countries took on additional debt in the decades, you know, between after the global financial crisis and up until 2020, 2021, when global interest rates were at record lows. You'll remember we had, you know, in some countries were able to borrow at negative interest rates. That's usually not the case for developing countries, but they did. They were able to borrow at relatively low interest rates, and their debt stocks grew quite significantly over that period. Then in 2022, we have this interest rate shock, and global interest rates rise very rapidly and really significantly. Right now, we have real interest rates at the highest in 30 to 40 years. And countries that have borrowed very cheaply 5-10 years ago and that need to refinance a bond this year or next year suddenly are faced with interest rates of 8%, 10%, 12%. So, you know, basically they are shut out of markets because these are not interest rates that you can sustainably service. So that affects many, many developing countries. It depends a bit on how you count and how you would assess it, but there are over 30 of the poorest countries that are considered either already in debt distress or at very high risk of debt distress. And then there's an even larger group of countries that have to use a very large share of their revenue just to service the interest on their debt. And as a result, they cannot spend it on healthcare, they cannot spend it on education, they cannot invest in the energy transition. So if you look at it from that perspective, you know, we estimate that more than 3 billion people now live in countries that have to spend more on their interest on debt than they can spend on health and education. So this affects a very large number of countries, and it prevents them from doing the things we want them to do, right? From investing in health, from investing in education, investing in climate action.
Is there room for debt forgiveness when we realize that this higher interest rates are going to be a factor? They're holding back achievement of the goals in this way, that there's going to be knock-on effects that will exacerbate them, like you say, by lack of investment in some of these key areas. So is there room there for some manner of debt forgiveness or deferral to calm things down?
Well, certainly that is one of the recommendations that we make, to at least consider deferrals, you know, reschedulings, so that you provide something like a debt service pause to countries that are overwhelmed right now by these very high interest payments at precisely a moment when global interest rates are so high. So that would also, especially if you're talking about creditors that have very long time horizons, a deferral should be something, if you think about the public creditors, that they should be able to absorb, because you're not writing off the debt, you're just giving countries a pause and a chance to grow out of the current crisis, and then they'll start servicing and repaying the debt at a later stage. So that is an ask that this report makes, that the international community should consider such deferrals for that group of countries. Now, there is also another group of countries where the debt levels are higher still, and they are clearly unsustainable. So a deferral wouldn't help, right? It would just kick the can down the road. And they do need some form of relief. They do need restructurings. And there are processes in place to help countries restructure their debt, but they don't work very well. So the question really is, how can we improve the debt resolution architecture for sovereigns? Right now, it typically takes too long, and then the relief that's provided is too little for countries to really sustainably grow out of their problem. Often they are back at the table a couple of years later because the relief provided wasn't large enough. So we have to find better ways to essentially restructure sovereign debt, just like we have, you know, procedures for commercial actors that are in default. We have ways to restructure that debt and to allow them to, you know, reinvest and grow, and that's in the benefit also of the creditors. And we don't have a good enough system for that for sovereign debtors. And that's something that's something we really need to work on as an international community.
It's not a pretty picture that's being painted here. It's one where it's going to require a lot of effort for these actors to step up and go forward, especially recognizing that by not meeting these goals, we're going to be living in a warmer planet where fewer people have the ability to adapt or to mitigate the impacts on this. And that is going to result in a lot of spin-off effects that we don't fully understand yet.
Indeed. Yeah. And if I may say, there's also a real sense of disappointment in the global south that we are not able to live up to some of these commitments. And that has repercussions too for our international community, right? For our ability to address global challenges, for our ability to work together on a wide range of issues where we do need international cooperation.
Yeah, exactly. Well, Oliver Schwenk, you've given us some food for thought here to sort of raise the alarm, shall we say, that the global sustainable development goals are not on track. They are very much off track, and getting them back to where we need them to be is going to require some really important shifts that go beyond platitudes or dealing with this idea by, as you say, kicking the can down the road. So I hope that those who have listened, if they're in the policy circles, if they're the students, if they're the educators, or if you're just listening to this on the way home from work, recognize that we are in this crisis together, and it's one that's going to require collective solutions to get through it. And they may be harder than we're emotionally prepared to take on. So, Oliver, thank you for bringing the gravitas to this discussion.
Thank you so much.